Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's very first road trip radio show with Nancy and Lisa. As many of you know, we are the crazy mother-daughter travel team. We travel full-time across the country, documenting parks and public lands. And we do this while we publish all kinds of Big Blend magazines, all digital, produce our podcasts, our Big Blend radio shows, and also we pet sit across the country, not for money. It's really just this cool way of traveling and getting ingrained in the different communities. We do that all through Trusted House Sitters. So if you're a pet parent or a traveler, check it out. It's pretty darn cool. It's been fun. But you know, we keep saying we need to do two different shows, road trip radio, because a lot of our radio parties, we do take a virtual road trip. So like now it's time to make it official. The other thing is to do rest area radio, because we stop at rest areas and we people watch. And that's a whole other thing. So watch for that. That's coming. We may actually have to start doing that in video. But anyway, I'm very excited to kick off this new show. It's going to air every fourth Monday. And you know, to kick this off, we're excited. It's June. To kick it off in June when everybody's out starting to plan their road trips, which you shouldn't overplan, by the way. You should let some spontaneity
happen.
Yeah, let some stuff happen. But summer is road trip season. And I do wish we had a station wagon. I really do. So this is perfect timing, but we couldn't even, you know, we can't pick the best guest. This is the best guest to kick it off. It is Wes Davis. He is joining us. He's a historian, a Yale professor, so he knows so much more than us. And he's an author, and his latest book is called American Journey on the Road with Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and John Burroughs. Did you know they did that? They did. They went on a road trip.
I want to be in the car with them.
This is an iconic historic road trip that happened with four American legends in August 1918. So the book is out now through W.W. Norton and Company. So get it wherever you buy books. But welcome to the show, Wes. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be here. I'm doing well, and I'm excited to talk about road trips. I want to give you one correction, though. I'm no longer a Yale professor. I left there about 15 years ago.
Oh,
and since then, I've been digging through archives to write books like this one.
Oh my gosh. So you are in the permanent, like it's a road trip thing, but it is the world of rabbit holes, because even before we push the record button, I'm like, I better stop. I get so excited about this stuff because it is fascinating, because when you follow a trail or a route, all of a sudden a gazillion stories pop
up.
How did you even finish this book without going off like in 20,000 different places? You know,
it was very easy to get lost. And, you know, I think digging through archives tends to take me down paths that I kind of can't get to the end of anyway. And this particular story was made for that. I mean, everywhere Ford and Edison and Burroughs and Harvey Firestone went, you know, it opens up a whole new sort of field for me to investigate.
I didn't even know they were friends. I didn't even know Thomas Edison would know about going on a road trip. I had no clue.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I really want to make it into a movie. It has to be a movie.
It does feel very much like a movie. And, you know, strangely enough, the world's first movie star was actually on the trip in 1918.
No way.
It's a very strange story. So as you know, Thomas Edison's laboratory developed motion picture technology. At the end of the 19th century, when they're beginning to experiment with, you know, this technology, they want to make a sort of test film. And so they recruit one of the guys who worked in Edison's laboratory. It was a man named Fred Ott. And he, you know, starred in this little short film in which he basically, I think, takes a pinch of snuff and then sneezes. And, you know, that's the film. But it was the first copyrighted film. And so in that sense, he was the first American movie star.
So what was his connection to like being that on a road trip, though?
So in 1918, he is actually one of the people Edison sort of recruited from among his employees to help with the logistics and drive one of the trucks. So Fred Ott is there on the road trip as kind of a key figure in, you know, getting everything together, getting supplies onto the truck, making sure they have everything they need.
Well, this is interesting too, because what you're saying, you know, even in the beginning of the book, I was reading about Burroughs, like he was in his 80s and he's like, dude, this is rough. I need cushions. You got cushions. I don't like, and then they're just camping, like they're doing this. So as you know, we host a Jefferson Highway show every fourth Thursday. And this is an iconic route started in 1915. So just before this, right? So this, the timing in this is incredible. And that goes from Winnipeg down to New Orleans. And right now, as we're recording this, it would have been done by the time this airs. They did it's their annual conference, and they're doing it in Mason City, Iowa. And they did a sociability caravan through Iowa, which was interesting. They even actually went into Minnesota. And I was like even hashtags on Instagram don't know what you're talking about. Nobody knows what a sociability caravan is. And their whole thing now is to also put markers where people camped. And I'm looking at some of the places they camped. I'm like, dude, there's alligators out there in Louisiana. They're camping right next to this. And so they were camping. And sometimes one of the ads for Natchitoches, Louisiana was offering free gasoline if you camped there. I'm going, that's not happening today.
Oh, but I would do it.
You know, but there's no one's giving you free gas now, but they did back then. But so going back to what you're saying with, you know, Ott being one of the truck drivers. So this literally as a road trip was a sociability caravan, right? How they traveled at that in that era with multiple people.
Yeah. So there are multiple people involved. And, you know, talking about camping, I should back up a little bit to say 1918 is the trip that I focus on most in the book. And that's this epic trip in which those members of the party who live in the Midwest, Ford and Firestone and Firestone's son, Harvey Jr., travel in from Firestone's farm in Columbiana, Ohio to Pittsburgh. Edison and Burroughs travel from West Orange, where Edison lives and where he has his laboratory, to Pittsburgh. And then they go down sort of through central Pennsylvania, up over the mountains, slice off part of Western Maryland, come down through West Virginia, Southwest Virginia, and then Tennessee and North Carolina up into the Smoky Mountains. So that's the focus of the book. But this story really starts in 1912. And I follow a whole series of trips. Ford and Burroughs travel up to Concord, Massachusetts. But then, and this is connected to your story of camping in Louisiana, Ford, Burroughs, and Edison get together at Edison's house, which is called Seminole Lodge down in Fort Myers. And, you know, they're there for a couple of weeks. And at a certain point, Edison decides that he wants to like give them a sort of deeper experience of Florida. Edison always wants to get into more rugged terrain. You know, when they're traveling by road, he wants to get on the worst roads. And so in 1914, he arranges for Ford and Burroughs to join him. And in this instance, their families go along too. Ford's wife, Clara, Edison's wife, Mina, and two of his children. And they go out into the Everglades. At first driving on roads, but you know, the Everglades is a completely undeveloped area at this time. And so eventually the roads disappear. They're sort of skimming over shallow lakes, you know, just sort of hoping that the bottom doesn't drop out. And they set up camp next to a kind of deep water lake out in the Everglades. And it's remarkable. You know, there's all kinds of wildlife around. Burroughs is hoping that he'll hear a cougar sort of growling, a panther growl, as he puts it. And this just becomes a kind of comedy of errors when a storm rolls in, knocks down their tents. Everyone winds up sleeping in, you know, puddles that are quickly turning into lakes. So they definitely had some of the experience you're talking about.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. But that's amazing how they were camping in those days. And we had this, you know, when we were in one spot. We've been on the road for a long time now, but We have this amazing black and white photo collection of, it's done through Turner Publishing, I believe, historic mm-hmm. photos of different communities. It's a big coffee table book size. And I remember the one for Tucson where we were based before we started traveling, you could see people out there with their Model T Fords in the middle of what is now Saguaro National Park for a picnic. And mm-hmm. you see these women in these formal dresses,
it's
you know,
crazy, huh?
with, you know, parasols, and they're sitting amongst cactus. And I'm going, I know exactly where the rattlesnake haven is there, and that spot. I know where they live.
Yeah.
And you're sitting in rattlesnake country, and you have a Model T Ford kind of thing going on. This is insane. It's just trippy to think of it now, where now we have to have the correct wheels and four-wheel drive, and we must now make sure that our backpacks have this, and we have the right camping stove. Whereas back then, they really did it.
In fact, one of the stories I tell, this is sort of the inspiration for I think road tripping for Ford and Edison, is that in 1915, when Ford and Edison are traveling out to the Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco, they go by train. But that same summer, their children, or two of their children, Ford's son Edsel and Edison's son Theodore, independently and separately travel out to the fair in Model T's. And mm-hmm. you know, so they're going through extremely rugged and remote country, and you know, roads are very primitive. And at one point, Edsel's party is camped in I think somewhere in Arizona, and they realize in the middle of the night that they have set up their tent on top of a tarantula nest.
Oh,
and so they're awakened in the night by spiders everywhere. And they abandon the tent and go and sleep in their cars, are not much more protective. You know, the Model T is completely open vehicle, but that's the kind of travel you could expect at that time.
I wanted to touch in on Roosevelt too, because he also, you know, was known. Teddy Roosevelt went to Africa a lot as his big, mm-hmm. you know, the Great White Hunter, which I'm not into, but you know, that's what he did. And I wonder about, you know, the history of it all. I'm trying to now, I need to like do a time chart or something. But when I think about how, you know, Yosemite, Yellowstone, and you think about John Muir and him having that famous meeting in in Yosemite, you think about that and, you know, you think John Muir was a vegan, here's Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the Great White Hunter, they have to camp under the stars. And you think about, you know, there's historic photos of, you know, these cars being out there, and trains were a huge way of artists getting around, and they had to transport like huge paintings across the country for people to see these landscapes, you know. And now I think about Africa, and that's our mm-hmm. our background is, you know, Kenya, South Africa, a little bit of Mexico and England. And when we were in Kenya and South Africa, you know, overland, you know, safaris were obviously, you know, it's a way of life, it's part of life, but the overland travel through the entire continent was so popular way back when, you know, the colonials did it. So I'm wondering mm-hmm. about the timing of these road trips, since America is actually the first, you know, place to form the National Park Service. And then Africa followed, but people are still exploring pre-parks, right? So I wonder about that connection. America starts the National Park Service, then Africa and everywhere, Australia, and you know, England starts catching on to do it. But I'm thinking about the road trip and the overland driving being connected to these road trips and Roosevelt. And I, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about how that probably ties in somewhere in history.
Yeah, well, so you know, this certainly links up with John Burroughs. Burroughs traveled with Teddy Roosevelt out to Yosemite, I think right after it became a park. And I should back up, because it's possible that listeners won't really know much about John Burroughs. So everybody knows Ford and Edison, but let me just say that. So Burroughs, as you mentioned earlier, is a considerably older man, a nature writer and essayist. At the time of the 1918 trip, he was 81. So he's just about a quarter of mm-hmm. a century older than Henry Ford. And mm-hmm. when Ford and Burroughs met, which is in or they make contact at the end of 1912. And we can talk about how that happens later if you'd like. But at that time, Burroughs is, you know, among the most popular writers in the country. He's got a couple of dozen books out, and he's writing in periodicals all the time. I mean, he's a very prolific writer. His essays are sort of constantly showing up. So everyone knows who John Burroughs is. And he's especially loved by school children because a number of his essays, you know, I guess maybe in part because they're on sort of wholesome topics. They're about nature, about bird life, about his travels with people like Teddy Roosevelt. Those essays are included in readers that are used in school systems throughout the country. And so in the early 20th century, wherever Burroughs went, you know, school children would sort of line up to see him, like, and they would want to know, you know, what's the great John Burroughs writing now. But his roots go back into the middle of the 19th century. He's born in 1837, I think, which is just about the time Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's sort of the, you know, foundational figure of American literature, this great transcendentalist philosopher and essayist. This is just about the time Emerson is writing and publishing his first collection of essays. And that sort of model, the transcendentalist model of Emerson, influences Burroughs really deeply. So that when Burroughs publishes his first major essay, I think in 1886 in the Atlantic Monthly, it's an essay called Expression. He sends it in, and the editor of the Atlantic reads it, thinks this is great, and his second thought is, this is plagiarized from Emerson. So he actually contacts Emerson, you know, to make sure this isn't one of his essays. Emerson says, no, but, you know, this is great. It's very much like my work. So it's published. And in that period, articles in the Atlantic were published anonymously. And so everyone assumed that this was by Emerson. And in Poole's Index, which was this kind of catalog of periodical literature at the time, it was actually listed as a work by Emerson.
Wow. So
that tells you something about, you know, where Burroughs's roots are. But after that essay came out, and after this kind of confusion about, you know, whether this was by Emerson, Burroughs realizes that he wants to create his own style. And what ultimately distinguishes him from people like Emerson is that he focuses much more closely on the actual details of the natural world, you know, what wildlife is really doing, what plant life really looks like. And so when his second book came out, Henry James, you know, the great novelist, reviews it, and he says that this new young writer is a more humorous and sociable Thoreau. So, you know, that's Burroughs. Wow. You know, that reputation is what puts him in touch with people like Teddy Roosevelt. They wind up traveling together. And it's exactly the paradox you were pointing to with John Muir, because Burroughs is very much a, you know, he does hunt. He hunts woodchucks, but, you know, he's not the great white hunter that Teddy Roosevelt wants to be. So they're out in the wilderness. And what they wind up doing is trying to identify bird calls. And they bond over this, and it turns out that Teddy Roosevelt, they have a kind of contest, and Teddy Roosevelt only loses by one species to Burroughs, who's kind of the foremost bird expert in the country.
Wow. Yeah, because I think he even the head of Audubon, and Audubon was a hunter too, by the way. I'm just going to bring that up to people that he was a hunter. I mean, it took a while for Audubon to kind of realize
Hunter, are you talking about somebody who feeds their family by shooting?
There's hunting
for trophy.
Yeah,
to stick on a wall.
Teddy Roosevelt did trophy hunting. He did. Right. He was. That's what I. You know. Yeah, then there's, I think Burroughs and Audubon probably did it, and Audubon shot birds too. More for the pot. And I think, you know, now we look at conservationism and, you know, a lot of times the hunters are the ones who actually know the land better than the environmentalists, saying, because they're out there watching and doing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's very controversial. Mm-hmm. We don't have to get into that right now. But
I will just say that
they're observant. Yeah.
In, in the case of Burroughs, he was a farmer. I mean, he continued to make his living as a farmer. And so woodchucks were a problem, you know, for the farmer. And so he was in a kind of constant war against them. I only know this sort of from information about Burroughs, but apparently a woodchuck is not particularly palatable, you know,
you
creature.
You can't eat it. Yeah.
But Burroughs did eat them. And I think it's because he didn't like the idea of destroying, you know,
wasting
a living creature. And so he came up with very elaborate ways to cook woodchuck to make them,
it's
to
a
make
big
them edible.
Rat. Yeah. It's a big rat.
But no, listen, I know you know that one portion of Tennessee. We were in Johnson City. We did a pet sit out there. And our pet sit became, we were taking care of three dogs, and one was a Boston Terrier that you don't mess with. And Boston Terrier went after, no, excuse me, not a Boston Terrier, a Frenchie, went after the woodchuck.
Oh, the French.
And the woodchuck was stealing eggs from the chickens.
Oh,
and our life became
bad.
I actually had to, I saved the woodchuck from the dogs. The dogs got the woodchuck. I saved the woodchuck. And then we figured out how to, we played farm and fixed things so that woodchuck couldn't steal eggs. Because we thought the dogs were stealing the eggs, but no, it was the woodchuck, and the woodchuck was heading next door. It's really, I mean, life is interesting on farms, man. And I think it's interesting because it's almost a closed circuit. You're in the same area watching. You start to, as an observer like Burroughs, start to watch, okay, the woodchuck, here's where the family is. Here's where the bird family is. Here's what this is. They, over like 2 to 3 years, you can really observe the family arc of each, you know, the web of life going on in your backyard. But then when you travel, man, it's like you're getting glimpses of it. And you have to be a very fast and deep observer to try and get the knowledge you have from being in one place like you would on a farm. So it's interesting about his travels, especially with Roosevelt, having those nature parts of it all.
Yeah.
The observancy.
And, you know, so Burroughs is the only member of this traveling party, Ford, Edison, Burroughs, and Firestone. He's the only one to continue to make a living as a farmer as an adult, but all of them grew up on farms.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's the thing that is the, I think, the fuel for these road trips, or it's nostalgia for farm life that, first of all, puts Ford in touch with Burroughs. So in 1912, the Model T has been out about 4 years and it's incredibly successful. You know, Ford is selling them as fast as he can possibly produce them. But so he's in his late 40s at this point, and he's becoming, as you know, as he becomes more and more successful as an automaker, he's becoming more and more nostalgic for life that he knew on the farm in Dearborn when he was a boy.
Sure.
And so one of the ways this manifests itself is that he becomes obsessed with this particular moment in his childhood, and he thinks of it as his earliest memory, and he actually writes this down in a little pocket notebook. And I would say that Ford was not a writer, and it's, you know, you don't find that much writing from him, but he wrote down this memory from a time when he was about 4 years old, and his father came and found him in the farmhouse, took him out into the fields. I think he's actually carrying Ford's younger brother, who's a couple of years younger, and they go out to a place in the field where a huge oak tree has fallen, and his father has young Henry bend down and look at this log, and shows him that there's a nest, that a song sparrow has made a nest there and left some eggs. And Ford, you know, all the way 40 years later, more than 40 years later, could remember this moment and could remember the song of the sparrow. And so for him, birds became this kind of link in later life to his agrarian childhood on the farm. And I think that's what got him interested in Burroughs. So he's reading Burroughs's books. Clara Ford gave Henry a full set of Burroughs's works. I think it was maybe a 20-volume set or something at that point. And so this is one of the few writers that Ford actually read. So he thinks of Burroughs as his favorite writer. And then late in 1912, he comes across some articles in which Burroughs is saying that the automobile is not kind of a path to wisdom, that, you know, it's likely to destroy nature. It hampers our appreciation of nature. because it carries us through the landscape too quickly. And so Ford, as you can imagine, disagrees with this, but he gets in touch with Burroughs and offers to send him a Model T to try to change his mind. And Burroughs sort of reluctantly agrees. And at the beginning of 1913, a Model T shows up at Burroughs's farm at Roxbury up on the Hudson. And that's the beginning of all of this.
Wow.
It's
and this is cool. Yeah, because you think about these guys, you've got Firestone and Ford knows how to do stuff too. And Ford is an interesting lesson in business. And he was, you know, we look at corporate America now versus what, you know, Henry Ford would, I think he would shake his stick. I would think he would take Teddy Roosevelt's, you know, bully stick and shake it right now with what's going on in the world. Because he was pro his employees. He was one of the first people, him and Carnegie, that said, and there's, you know, negative stuff on him too. I mean, no one's perfect, but was for like, if you want to, you know, get your employees to really work, give them a bonus. You know, you've got to give them something. You've got to keep them inspired. You've got to take care of them. And so there's all kinds of things on all of that, but I find it interesting to have him, Firestone, Burroughs, and Edison. So we have scientists, we have inventors, we have business people, we have naturalists all together with extreme different personalities. And as we all know, you go on a road trip across the country and you think you like someone, you'll find out by the end of the road trip.
Yeah.
By the end, you find out like in the first hour.
You're
like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Road trips are personal and how you handle it. And then I'm going, these cars were not like what we have now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But how much fun. Come on.
Well, just, I mean, to, just to pick ahead. Up, I'm sorry, to pick up what you're saying about Ford paying his employees. I think that, you know, his famous announcement in 1914 of the $5 workday, that was the biggest benefit for labor, you know, in history up to that point. And it basically doubled the going rate for a day's work. And at the same time, Ford shrank the workday from 9 hours to 8, you know, so this is like, he really is giving a better deal to his employees. And I make the case in the book that is actually something that comes out of these road trips, or it comes out of Ford's friendship with Burroughs and the first road trip they take together, which I think maybe I mentioned before, is up to Concord, Massachusetts. And, you know, Burroughs had received the Model T, and to his surprise, he found that he did sort of enjoy some of the benefits it gave him, that he could get out into the countryside and see, you know, more of nature in an afternoon than he could at his age then if he were just walking. And so Burroughs in 1914, or sorry, later in 1913, wants to come out to visit. Ford wants to come out to visit Burroughs, and Burroughs wants to give him something, you know, that's sort of to compensate for the car he's just received from Ford. So he takes Ford up to Concord and shows him Emerson's house. They go out to Walden Pond, you know, where Thoreau had lived. And Ford becomes really fascinated by Emerson. And he writes to a friend after this and says that that Burroughs gave me Emerson. And he begins reading Emerson and especially fixates on the essay Compensation, in which Emerson talks about sort of, you know, fairness in your dealings in the world. And Emerson was kind of responding, reacting against a kind of idea in Protestant religion in New England at the time, which sort of said, good people are going to suffer in this life and bad people are going to do well, but in the afterlife that will all be compensated. And Emerson said, no, just look at nature, you know, everything is immediately compensated. I mean, even at the level of physics, an action has a reaction. And you know, so he argued that if there's a great line, the swindler swindles himself. So if you cheat in your dealings, it's going to affect you immediately in one way or another. He says, if the man harvests too much, nature takes out of the man what she puts into his chest, meaning like his treasure chest. And it's like, Ford was
sustainability.
Really
sustainability. you can't sustain if you keep.
Yeah, right. And this really influenced Ford. And so it's, you know, that's in the late summer of 1913. In December, Ford sees a couple of his workers fighting in the, on the factory floor. He says they're like trying to kill, beat each other to death. He stops the fight, and then he's, you know, he can't let it go. He keeps wondering, like, why is this happening? And what he comes up with is that it's poverty and that he plays a role in this. And so in January of 1914, he announces he's going to pay $5 a day. And a reporter goes out to the factory to talk to Ford about this. It's a reporter from the Chicago Day Book, which is a was a kind of pro-labor publication. And she asks Ford, you know, why did you do this? And he says at that point, it's social justice. And that to me doesn't sound like Ford's language. So I think maybe the PR department had gotten involved at that point. But, you know, he did want to sort of pay the workers fairly. And what's interesting to me is that the photo he gives the reporter to illustrate this article about the $5 day is a photo that had been taken when Burroughs visited him in Detroit. And they sat in Ford's first vehicle, which was this little sort of spindly thing called the quadricycle. And the photo, the quadricycle didn't have a steering wheel. It had a tiller to
steer. I love it.
And so the photo that Ford gave to illustrate the $5 day showed him sitting in the quadricycle with Burroughs, and it's Burroughs's hand that's on the tiller. And I know I may be making too much of this, but to my mind, that's Ford signaling that Burroughs and the introduction he gave Ford to Emerson is behind the $5 workday. And so a road trip leads to that sort of great moment in labor history.
It's just fascinating.
That's a funny photo.
But this the history to me of this is what's so fascinating is road trips, these conversations happen. You're seeing something, you're in you're all out of your comfort zone.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's just this free-for-all, and you've got all these iconic people that are making history every day, making history as they're doing this. And about 6 years ago, we interviewed, I'm going to get his name in a second. Mitch Horowitz. He at the time was vice president and executive director at Penguin and Penguin Random House. And the book I'm just looking up now is How to Own Your Own Mind. And it was written by Napoleon Hill. And it was like one of these hidden manuscripts, and the Napoleon Hill Foundation found it, published it. And it was all these interviews, and Ford and Edison were in there. And it was Ford talking about and Edison, I mean, here they are friends, which I didn't know. Like, you know, who I just had no clue about this. But it was that book for folks too, just to add that into this perspective of, you know, because Napoleon Hill was running around. I mean, you got to think he was road tripping everywhere doing these interviews with these guys. And, you know, just all of these, and this was 20 years, 30 years later. But it's fascinating to me how they were looking at things so quickly and making these changes and looking at the greater future. I mean, if they would see what was now, I would love to sit down with all of them now and go on a road trip and see, you know, what they think of today and, you know, infrastructure too. But how did you find this story and even get all this information about their conversations on their road trips and how they felt in the cars? Was it all stories, you know, from the press? But how did you find this story? It's amazing.
Well, so it was a mixture of lots and lots of different sources. So I first became aware of the story when Burroughs is somebody I've been interested in for a long time. And I was digging through his correspondence. I sort of, you know, another kind of obsession of mine is literary correspondence. I love to see you know, writers writing to each other. So I was looking through Burroughs's letters, and I found a letter from the end of 1912, in which Burroughs is writing to a friend of his, and he says, "Mr. Ford of automobile fame is an admirer of my books, and he wants to send me a Model T." And I thought, God, that's very strange. You know, there's nobody I could sort of less associate with auto travel than Burroughs, because I at that point, I was more focused on his earlier career, you know, when he was a friend of Walt Whitman's, for example, and friend of Emerson's. And so I dug into this and I found that not only did Ford send him a Model T, but the two became friends and they wound up traveling together. And then that Thomas Edison was a member of the party. And, you know, I thought, like, this story is sort of made for me because, I mean, as you mentioned at the beginning, I spent my earlier life as an academic. So I spent 10 years in graduate school, getting a PhD, and then another 10 years as an English professor. And in all of that time, I wrote about writers. But as my sort of term in my last job came to a close, I realized that I wanted to write for a broader audience. And I had already started writing for newspapers and things like that. And it turned out that the step in that direction for me was to write about writers who had escaped from the library or escaped from the study and were out in the world doing something more adventurous. And so my first book was about a group of British scholars, classicists and archaeologists, who, because they had studied ancient Greek, which gave them a kind of leg up in learning modern Greek, were recruited by the British Army in World War II to serve as commandos in Greece during the Nazi occupation of Greece.
Mm. Wow.
And that, you know, that was an amazing thing to work on because you have this incredible sort of spy story. Mm. They actually kidnapped the German general who commanded the division that occupied Crete, and they kind of got him up over the mountains and off the island, and he was taken to Cairo, which was the British base in the region. But so they're doing all those things, but they're writers. And so, like, the stuff, you know, the reports they're sending are like incredible. And when I found this story, I realized that this had very much the same shape. You know, you have Burroughs keeping a journal about all of this. And you have Ford and Edison, who are not writers, but they're people that we, you know, primarily know about for their intellectual accomplishments. But this whole group is then getting out into the world and having an adventure that we would not associate with them at a time when, you know, the world is really changing. And the kind of adventure they're having is just becoming possible for the first time in history.
Mm. That's amazing. And when you're, you know, researching this and putting it together, because it's really, it's character driven, you know, it is.
Yeah.
And Model T Ford driven too. to put that in there. But it's interesting because they go out into the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains area, which is iconic, you know, and beautiful. But I wanted to ask you as a writer, because you are an amazing writer. You get us immediately. You're in.
You
are an amazing storyteller for history, which it's crucial that we have storytellers for history. So it's not this dull thing that youth don't want to learn,
history
or
class.
Even adults. It's really not even an age thing.
They should put historic novels into history class.
Yeah, I know, but this
Instead
is a true story,
textbook.
Right? But
yeah.
You feel like you're reading a novel. And that's, you know, full of life. It's like, wow, you know, it really happened, you know? And so I think it's so crucial for writers like you to be in our world to educate and remind us all that history is about stories. And once you realize that, then everything's a rabbit hole. And I love rabbit holes, as you know.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about writing, because here dealing with Burroughs, you've got Thoreau, Emerson, right? Did any of them kind of, you know, did you get kind of stuck in their writing as writers and kind of go, ooh, I got any lessons from them that you took home from this experience?
I will just say that I agree with you that history needs to have that narrative element, you know, that storytelling is, I mean, there are different kinds of history, you know, so when I was writing about the war in Crete, I realized I'm not a military historian, so I can't write that kind of book that, you know, is about this unit moves to this position and they fortify. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't write that way. But what I could do was tell stories, and I really enjoy digging into the archives to get enough up close information to be able to tell stories. So, I mean, I was influenced by Burroughs in the sense that although I already liked him, reading his journal, I just came to love him. You know, he, on the actual trips, he's often moaning. I mean, I think you pointed out that he complains about the, you know, being bounced around on the roads, and the kind of famous moment about that is when he points to Edison and says, "Well, of course you don't mind this because you're all cushiony." But you know, Edison was sort of the stout figure at this point, and Burroughs, you know, weighed 120 or 130 pounds, and so he had no cushioning. So, you know, he didn't always on the trips make himself lovable, but his journal certainly makes him lovable. And, you know, so I really absorbed, I think, a lot of his view of the world. And some of the things that are kind of difficult to handle in the book, you know, Ford has a kind of increasing level of anti-Semitism through this period. And when I initially found this story, I thought, well, maybe I don't want to write about Henry Ford, you know, because that was one of the things I knew people would associate with him. But first of all, I came to see much more of Ford and found that he's this incredibly complicated, fascinating kind of figure. And I also found that I could look at something like the anti-Semitism through Burroughs's eyes, and it would really give us not a way of understanding it, because I don't think Burroughs understood it and historians don't understand it. It doesn't really seem to fit with Ford's character. But at least I could see it from the outside, you know, and deal with it again as a story in Burroughs, you know, reacting to it rather than sort of trying to treat it in the way a conventional historian might.
He could have been brought up that way by his parents. Could be handed down that way.
I think part of it had to do with the fact that, as I said before, Ford was a farm boy, and he became successful because he was obsessively interested in one thing, which is the internal combustion engine and the way it could be applied, you know, to creating an automobile. And when he became successful, a lot of people became involved in his business who were there not because they were obsessed with that technology, but because they wanted to make money. And so, you know, all through his early career, he had investors whom he needed, you know, he needed financial help to get started, but they would then push him in directions that he didn't believe were the way to go. And so, you know, just to take one example, some of the early investors wanted him to produce a bigger, heavier, more expensive car. And Ford always wanted to make a car that, you know, could be affordable to the masses. He really believed in that. And so I think, you know, he's reacting against the whole kind of financial world in a way that, you know, sort of makes sense given his trajectory. But then what goes wrong is that he begins to associate the financial world with a particular religious background.
And, yeah. It's interesting because we did an interview, I think it was back in February, on George Washington Carver. It was on our Jefferson Highway show because his birthplace is in Missouri. And it's actually the very first national monument for African-Americans his place. And we started looking at his history as a farmer, as a botanist, trying to teach people that you can use what you have for more things than one use. And, you know, he was an educator. I mean, George Washington Carver is like just one of my favorite people too. And then digging into the history, we had a gentleman on who portrays him as a one-act play. And he was talking about his relationship with Ford. So he, you know, as he was learning more and more and more and teaching people and doing all these things, he started to become friends with Henry Ford. And that made a lot of African-American people who thought he was standing up for them, why are you friends with Ford now? Now you're becoming one of them. And that became an issue. So it's interesting because it is, you can't just say a person is just this way. It's complex. You know, relationships are complicated and complex. They always are. And I think Ford had a lot of those different relationships, yet was complex. And like what you're saying with the anti-Semitism part, which is unfortunate, but then at the same time, his friend, I think they were trying to communicate on more science and things. And George Washington Carver was trying to help, you know, Black people rise up with banking and things like that. So I think in a way he was, it's weird because he was so good about people, justice, social justice, but then there he is, you know, that is wild.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, everyone who knew Ford personally seems to have liked him. I mean, it was really odd because he doesn't seem like the most socially adept person, but, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, Burroughs was incredibly fond of him. And, you know, I think I was sort of thinking about what these road trips meant in general. And I talked, you know, a little bit about some of the things that come out of them. There, you know, there's also just thinking about conservation. In the 1918 trip, this party can't possibly pass a grist mill, like an abandoned water wheel driven mill, without stopping to look at it. And that's because Ford, you know, in company of people like Burroughs, is becoming more and more interested in water power and getting away from big factories that are sort of belching out smoke and forcing people to be concentrated into cities in order to be employed. So all through that trip, I mean, I became self-conscious in writing about it because so many times I write, you know, oh, and then they saw a mill and they stop and, you know, Ford takes everyone over to like climb on the water wheel and explore the mill. And Ford is calculating how much power that mill could produce if he got it working again. And so after this trip, Ford, or on the course of the trip, I guess he's formulating this idea for something he called village industries. And what he wanted to do was take these old grist mills, convert them to small factories that would be driven by water power. They would be just by nature in rural communities because those are the communities the mills had served. And it would give a kind of lifeline to farmers by giving them employment in the off season. So, you know, you get away from centralized manufacturing, you sort of pump a new lifeblood into rural farming communities. And, you know, that, I mean, I think this would be an amazing thing to have happening today. Ford actually did it. Just after the 1918 trip, he starts this program. I think the first one of these he bought is at a place called Nankin Mills. And he took an old grist mill and converted it into a factory to produce a certain valve for the Model T. So each factory would produce just one little component, and then they would be shipped somewhere to assemble the car. And through the course of the next 20 or so years, he opens up, sort of depending on how you define them, between 20 and 30 of these village industries plants.
Wow.
And he actually, on the 1919 trip, in which the campers go up into the Adirondacks and then across Vermont and down through New Hampshire, they stop first at Green Island on the Hudson, where Ford is opening up a plant like this, in which he takes a kind of dam across a part of the Hudson and builds a tractor plant next to it. And he actually has Burroughs and Edison and Firestone chisel their initials in the cornerstone for this to sort of commemorate that this is an idea that came out of their travels together.
This is amazing. I mean, now you've got Edison though, right? When he's looking at these mills, did Edison go like, hell, I want to go look at this, shine a light on that? I mean,
yeah, Edison was also into this idea. And in fact, the site at Green Island is one that Edison had alerted Ford to, because Edison had a manufacturing plant of some kind near there, and he liked to fish in that area. And he had spotted the dam, but the dam was already built, but it was not being used to generate water power, hydroelectric power. And so Ford and Edison together could not let that happen. You know, it was just a waste as they saw it. And so Edison sort of helps Ford track down the owner of this. And, you know, Ford winds up building this plant there. And that so these village industries plants grew all through the 30s, and a number of them opened during the Great Depression, you know, when they really were a lifeline to farmers, because you know, it was very hard to make a living farming at that time. But after Ford's death, these things started to close down. I think the last one to close was the Nankin Mills site, which was actually the first to open, and that closed sometime in the 80s, I think maybe around 81. But the Green Island facility, although the tractor plant closed down, the hydroelectric plant is still generating power there that's used by the community in that area.
Cool. Wow. This is fascinating, because when you think about road trips, and here it is, our first road trip radio show, like that is actually built that way, that we've done tons of road trip shows. But when you think about the power of a road trip, right? There's that excitement and that freedom. There's a personal freedom you get out of it. And especially if you have not over planned it. I'm just saying, sometimes you just got to let it happen. It's true. And they did that. They didn't know where they were going to camp half the time, you know?
Yeah, like, they rarely did. I mean, Edison who planned the itineraries for all these, but it was a sort of seat of the pants thing. And Edison would ride in the passenger seat of his car, which was a Simplex touring car. And he had a driver, but he would ride in the passenger seat with geological survey maps open on his lap and the automobile blue book, which I don't think we've talked about, but that was another of my sources for this.
Really? Kelly's at that time or no?
It was called the Automobile Blue Book, and they published them for various regions every year. And if you think about it, these had to be incredibly detailed, because there's no infrastructure for long distance travel like this. You know, you have pretty good roads in the cities, but very poor roads for getting between cities. And they're not signposted because, you know, they're mostly used by farmers who are trying to get the harvest to the mill or whatever. And so the Blue Book gave incredibly detailed itineraries. Like, if you want to get from this town to that town, here's how you do it. And it would be down to the micro level. So when you come to this fork in the road, you're going to see a stone horse watering trough and you want to bear left, you know, and so they're really detailed. And because I had itineraries that Firestone recorded after each trip, I could see what towns they were passing through and actually figure out which of these Blue Book itineraries they were on, which allowed me to really follow their progress turn by turn almost. And at the same time, you can imagine, with people this well known passing through these small towns, every newspaper records their passage through their town.
Yeah, and newspapers,
and eventually, you know, reporters are tracking them, saying, you know, oh, Ford and Edison are expected to be here. We think they might arrive tomorrow afternoon, you know. And so that by putting together all of these sources, you know, the maps and guidebooks and newspaper reporting, Burroughs's journal, Firestone's narrative, letters from Burroughs and occasional letters from Ford, telegrams, you know, because they're constantly sending telegrams back to their business operations. And like, so when I first started this book, and this was true of the previous book too, I thought, you know, because I want to do this in a kind of novelistic narrative way, I really need a lot of information. And in both cases, I basically panicked for a year or two, thinking I'll never get enough information. And I just, as you keep digging, I actually wound up with too much information in both cases. You know, there's just there's so much to put together.
I want the Blue Book thing, because now, so I wonder, like, I would immediately go to Kelly's Blue Book, like, for values of cars, but now I wonder if their name came from that. And then you got to think about what became AAA, you know, after all the, you know, with the maps and all of that, you know. I don't know if people go to their AAA store anymore and go get their maps and things plotted out.
Yeah, the triptych, right?
Yeah. I wonder, you know, it's now, I mean, it's easier to have a little bit of spontaneity now with, we have GPS and we have cell phones and you know, I know our tourism people are going to get mad when I said, like, have that spontaneity and don't overplan. But if you follow certain routes and stuff, you give yourself that breather to do have those memories be made and do things like pull over at the grist mill. So it's interesting to me how a road trip can spur industry. Salespeople, traveling salespeople, know back roads and know roads and diners, I think, more than travelers. Like, traveling salespeople, delivery people, people who are on the road for a living know all these, they know the best restrooms. They know, I'm serious, that's a real deal on road trips. Trust me, I can tell you who does not have rest areas. I can tell you where you need to get gas in this country before you think you don't need to. Don't wait till the quarter. No, don't do it in certain places, especially New Mexico. So seriously, Northern New Mexico, you go pee-pee when you have an ability to.
Yeah, because
as soon as you
miles.
See the pee-pee place and the gas, and you better do it.
With gas, you better fill up.
Whenever you get those opportunities in certain areas, you better do it. Don't leave too much to chance. But to me, that's the most exciting thing. It's kind of like when Seinfeld, that episode of Seinfeld where Kramer drove a UPS truck or something? And it went on the empty light and they went to see how far you could go on the empty light or the gas. I'm like, that's it. That's what road trips are about. But your story is just like this, you know, all these different characters, like were true legends in history and for so many different reasons, inventions, nature, science, business, getting together, those communications, planning, researching and developing. And so road trips and conservation, like you're saying too, conservation of buildings, conservation of nature, road trips do so much and it expands our mind. It's also humbling because you go through places and learn things that you go, wow, you know, it's good to take a breather from the news and all of that, which is important to know about, but to actually remember when you cross the country and you go on these smaller byways, especially to connect with people, actual people. And when you do, it doesn't really matter about what political party anymore. Have those conversations, have that small town American experience because it still does exist. It's beautiful and it's amazing. And I think your book brings us back to that spirit of what America can still be. Do you think that? When you were writing this, that kind of, I'm not trying to romanticize it, but you know what I mean? There's a good feeling about it.
Right. Well, I think there is a kind of romance to anything that's in its infancy, and road travel was in its infancy, you know, and all the things we kind of today associate with the road trip, you know, the roadside culture of motels and gas stations and rest stops, rest areas. None of that, of course, existed, you know. It was difficult to get gas. And in fact, especially difficult in 1918 because the First World War, the US had now joined the First World War. And so there were, you know, there was gas rationing and sometimes it was very difficult for this group to get gas to get to the next town. But there was also no kind of support. You know, there were garages in towns and cities, but there wasn't sort of roadside assistance of any kind. And so often when these cars broke down, it was Henry Ford, you know, at this point, one of the richest men in the country, who climbs out of the car, rolls up his sleeves, gets underneath and figures out what's going on. And I mean, there's one amazing moment and they had just started the 1918 trip. So I think this is their second day. So they've come from Pittsburgh, spent the night in a town in the mountains outside Pittsburgh. And then they're approaching a town called Connellsville, and the Packard that Harvey Firestone had and that Ford was riding in that day broke down. And it turned out that the cooling fan had broken and one of the iron arms of the cooling fan had pierced the radiator. So Ford gets out and manages to, you know, sort of get this patched up enough to get into the town of Connellsville. They get there, find a garage, the mechanics look at it and say, there's no way to repair this. You know, we'll have to just order replacement parts. And so—
And they're talking to Ford.
Right, exactly. So
that's funny.
Again, Ford says, well, you know, give me a chance. And he starts looking around the garage and he's just like taking things, you know, off workbenches and off the wall and like finding things he can use. And he wires the fan back together, solders the radiator, and within 2 hours they're back on the road.
And amazing,
you know, that at this point the head of the shipping board was a man named Edward Hurley, was traveling with them just for a day or two, and he wrote about this and he said that, you know, Ford took this moment that could have really destroyed a road trip. I mean, he wouldn't have called it a road trip, but could have destroyed a trip like this. And he turned it into the, you know, the highlight of the trip. Like everybody was, you know, talking about how wonderful this was that he was able to make the repairs so quickly.
Well, don't we say that, Nancy? I mean, even through Africa, if you didn't break down in the middle of the bush, like you didn't have a proper road trip.
You didn't have a road trip.
Yeah. I remember one time.
You have to break down.
Yeah. We broke down. We were changing a flat tire and I don't know if it was Masai Mara where we were.
Oh, God.
And here we were, and it took a couple hours. I mean, at that time there was like, you know, sanctions and bans on things. So literally you did patch your tires, right? And drive on them.
You know what? I patched Band-Aids. Tires with bicycle tire patches.
There's all kinds of stuff
it was
we did
nuts.
To rig things. So we go around the bend, like literally around the corner. And here we are outside the car carrying on. There was a pride of lions. You think we're not going to remember that? Like, seriously. Yeah. And they were watching us like, you idiots.
They're like, look at those humans.
Yeah. So it's crazy. But I love what you've written. And I, as you can tell, I'm a little bit overpassionate about it because it's so exciting. And I had no idea. And I can't wait to finish the book and for everyone to read it and go get it. I do want to close because I want to give a shout out to our friends over at the Lion and the Rose Bed and Breakfast in Asheville, North Carolina. Talking about writers and geniuses getting together. This city, Asheville, North Carolina, is a hub of creativity. Everyone from F. Scott Fitzgerald to Thomas Wolfe, O. Henry, Zelda Fitzgerald, Warren Haynes, a musician. I always got to give him a shout out. So if you go to Asheville, go to lion-rose.com. And they're outside the Smoky Mountains, which includes one of the road trips, right? That area got into the book.
That's right. In fact, it's Asheville that's the final destination of the 1918 trip. That's the Grove Park Inn in Asheville is where they spend their last night together.
Do you know that it's haunted?
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
I do believe so. I think it was we went on the Gray Line trolley tour. They go outside the Grove.
It's haunted.
No, the Grove Inn is a big deal. There's stories of massacres and all kinds of stuff. I shouldn't say that. That's not the, you have to talk to Uncle Ted from Grayline. If you go in our October show, you'll hear about the haunted mysteries of Asheville, because Asheville is like the downtown. You're walking on dead people that were all buried underneath these certain streets. Well, because of, you know, there was, you know, things happened and they didn't have graveyards at that time. Like enough places. There was illness that went through
and they just buried people. Built over.
But the Grove, I didn't. That's people. Amazing. So, now I have to get to the end of the book. I have to. See? So, everyone, again, the book is out now. It's by Wes Davis. It's called American Journey on the Road with Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and John Burroughs. It is out now. So, get it where all your books are. Do you have a website for everyone to go to, or should they just go to this site?
I don't have a website, but it's all in the book.
All right. Everyone, go check it out. Thank you so much. Now keep up with our brand new show, our Big Blend Radio Road Trip Show. Go to bigblendradio.com. We will air this every fourth Monday. And who knows where we're going next month. Thanks so much, Wes.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm looking forward to the book about your travels.
Uh-oh. We'll call you to write it.
Yeah.